Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to bridging the gap between adventure and adventurer by helping people select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins, and this is how many of us met Harry Connick Jr. through his hit soundtrack to the film When Harry Met Sally.
It had to be you. It had to be you. I wandered around and finally found the somebody who could make me be true, could make me be blue, or even be glad just to be sad thinking of you.
His dulcet vocals in that film and on countless other tracks and albums eclipsed for a moment just how accomplished a musician he is. Here he is at the piano with Sweet Georgia Brown. That skill took years to develop, but emerged early. Here's Harry Connick playing the same tune at age 11. And Harry Connick Jr. joins us for the hour from Florida. Good morning. Welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks. It's good to be with you.
How did you get a recording contract at the age of 11? I'm just curious about that.
Well, you know, it wasn't a recording contract because my parents, you know, who were such huge supporters of what I was doing and what my sister was doing, you know, they were just great, influential parents. They wanted me to have an opportunity to go in the studio and record, so I actually did an album when I was about 9 years old and then another one when I was 11. So I was just really lucky to, you know, have parents like that and also grow up in a town like New Orleans where there was music everywhere and there were opportunities to play with great musicians.
You actually began playing, I read, at the age of 3. Is that accurate?
It's accurate, but I'm not so sure how impressive that is, only because I don't think I was playing anything that great, you know, when I was young.
At three, your hands are so small, I'm not sure how you could
play. And I think the novel thing was probably my interest. You know, I was so interested in playing, and that's really all I wanted to do.
Yeah.
So I think that was probably the more interesting thing, than any kind of musicianship.
Where do you think that comes from, this knowledge at the age of 3, that that's all you wanted to do?
I have no idea. I guess it was a combination of, you know, the genetics I inherited. You know, just both my parents loved music. There was some musicianship on my mother's side of the family, and my father loves, you know, performing. So maybe it was just that particular combination that led me to being fascinated by it.
And is it true that you were first performed at the age of 5?
Yeah, so my dad was the district attorney of New Orleans.
Right.
And when he was opening up his campaign headquarters back in 1973, I guess it was, I was 5 years old, and I played the Star Spangled Banner at the inauguration, and it was just an incredible experience for me. It was the first time I was able to connect with a group of people in a public setting, and it stuck with me and became something that I became obsessed with.
Do you remember that, really? Remember doing that? Remember how you felt when you performed in front of a crowd of people like that at 5?
I do. I don't have a lot of memories from that age, but I do remember that. I remember kind of looking up and seeing the audience there, being appreciative after I played it, and thinking this is such an amazing feeling. You know, I can press these keys on this piano and people respond to it. And I just never forgot that feeling.
At what point did people begin to understand the real nature of your talent? Because at some point I would think that people realized that you were a prodigy.
You know, I always shied away from that term only because it seems so much more impressive than anything I was doing. I really loved playing, and I loved being around musicians. And, you know, from the time, you know, I was 3 and 4 years old, that's when my mother really noticed that I was obsessed with it. That's all I wanted to do. And then over the years, you know, I became a pretty familiar person at a lot of those clubs on Bourbon Street. You know, we would go down on the weekends during the day, and there'd be music playing on Saturday afternoons and Sunday afternoons. And those musicians came to be very familiar with me and my family. We would drop by and listen and eventually start sitting in with them and playing with them. So it was pretty early on that people knew that I was pretty serious about it.
What's it mean that you enjoyed being around musicians? What's that feeling like? What was that feeling like for you at the time before you became the Harry Connick Jr. that we all know?
Well, these were grown-ups. You know, when you're 7, 8 years old and you're passionate about something and you see grown-ups that are passionate about the same thing, it's just an incredible kinship that you develop with these folks. It was amazing to me to think that a kid could have something in common with grown-ups, and this is how they made their living. You know, they spent all of their time doing exactly what I love to do. So it was something that I felt I had in common with people that I admired who were my elders, and that was a very empowering feeling.
You know, New Orleans is a very special place in America. There's no other city like New Orleans in the entire continental United States, and maybe not in the world. And a lot of that comes from the music of New Orleans and the musicians that hang around New Orleans and have made it such a great fertile ground for music and musicians. If you had grown up in another city, do you think you would have been attracted to music, or that you would have developed in the way that you did?
I would have been attracted to music, but I definitely wouldn't have developed in this way. New Orleans, you know, has a way of sort of infiltrating your entire life. It sort of comes to you, the music, the food, the people, the way of life. It's just an incredible community, as you said. And so had I been brought up in New York or maybe a small town in the Midwest, I'm not so sure that, well, I'm positive I wouldn't be the musician I am now, because so much of what I do is as a result of being completely surrounded by music my whole life and having access to it. So not only did my parents love music and they had records playing in the house all the time, you know, a 10-minute drive away, you could be listening to some people who were actually around when jazz music was being invented. I mean, people who were really on the scene, you know, in the 20s and 30s. I mean, that's just an incredible opportunity for somebody like me. So if it had been somewhere else, I'm not so sure what I would have turned out like.
I also think that your growing up is a testimony to your parents in many ways. People don't understand sometimes how influenced children are by parents and what they do, not so much what they say, but how they live their lives. And you mentioned that your father performed and there were records playing in the house all the time. Your parents were really accomplished. Your father was district attorney. Your mother, I think, was a lawyer and later a state Supreme Court judge. And I find it interesting that they encouraged you because usually people in those professions want their kids to do something stable that they can make
right.
a living at. And they encouraged you to go on and pursue a musical career.
They did. You know, my mom, I know it probably says it online that my mother was a Supreme Court judge in Louisiana. She wasn't. She was a judge in New Orleans, but she was a judge, and my dad was a DA. And it was, you know, very fortunate for me and for my sister that we had two parents who were supportive of their children and wanted them to excel in the things that they loved. they were really supportive of both of us. You know, my sister is now a colonel in the Army. She's a psychiatrist and an internist. And, you know, she always was interested in languages and helping people and being a person that could serve others. And, you know, I was always interested in performing and being a musician and entertainer. And and our parents just found opportunities for us to learn and grow. And that was the best example, you know, for both me and my sister as parents now, is to, you know, realize that, you know, you have to try to tap into whatever creativity or passions your children possess so that they can ultimately, you know, go after the things that they love.
It takes a lot of time to develop the kind of skills that you have as a musician and that you seem to have had since a very early age, a lot of dedication. How did you approach that aspect of your life growing up? How much did you practice, for instance? Because your skills at the keyboard are unbelievable.
Oh, thanks. It was a group effort. You know, like, I wasn't a huge fan of practicing, but I practiced a lot, you know, because...
What's a lot? Is it 3 hours a day? Is it an hour a day? Is it 8 hours a day? What is it?
Well, at times it would be, you know, 6 or 8 hours a day, depending on what was going on. You know, I was a classical musician and as well as a jazz musician. So, you know, when you're preparing for competitions, you know, you spend a lot of time behind the piano. And then I had teachers that were extremely demanding. So, you know, from the time I was probably... I guess 9 or 10, you know, I mean, I was playing, you know, with the symphony at that age. So, you know, you have to practice all the time. You know, I didn't play any sports. I didn't do anything, you know, extracurricular. It was all music all the time. And any chance I had, I was either studying or practicing, because that's just what you had to do.
It seems that the classical music discipline is very different from jazz, because jazz is a lot of improvisation, and classical musicians want to play it exactly the way the composer wrote it. You seem to be able to function well in both worlds. How do you explain that?
Well, you know, you do, you know, what your elders do, and Ellis Marsalis was my teacher, and I went to a school called the New Orleans Center for Creative Arts, and people like Wynton Marsalis, you know, went to school there, Branford Marsalis, and you just played classical and jazz. That's what you did. And the level of instruction was so high and so rigorous that you just did what they told you to do. And for the musicians that played jazz, and there were a whole bunch of us, when you have a teacher like Ellis, you know, it was extremely strict, and you know, you had to live up to a certain standard. You had to do your homework. You know, if they told you to go home and practice this piece of music and, you know, learn it by, you know, next Tuesday, you had to do it.
Back to our conversation from last month with Harry Connick Jr. in just a moment. He's a Grammy and Emmy Award winner who was also nominated for Best Actor in a Musical on Broadway. We're talking about his musical beginnings in the city of New Orleans, which celebrates its 300th anniversary this year. More with Harry Connick Jr. in just a moment on Charlotte Talks. Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that believe a car is used for more than just getting from place to place. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. We're listening back to our conversation last month with Harry Connick Jr., who visited Charlotte as part of his tour celebrating the 300th birthday of New Orleans. Harry Connick Jr.'s musical roots are in New Orleans, and we talked about how the city, jazz, and the Great American Songbook shaped him. You came into your own as a singer at a time when a whole new generation of artists began to embrace what has come to be called the Great American Songbook. That catalog is a catalog of standards written by incredible composers and performed by people like Frank Sinatra and Tony Bennett and Rosemary Clooney and others. And you quickly made inroads into that genre. Talk about those songs and why they appealed to you as a young man from a different generation and why you think so many young people embraced your performances of those songs.
I think the reason I got interested in it was because as a jazz musician, those are the songs that you play. You know, it's that group of songs from which you choose material to improvise upon, you know, like the George Gershwin song and Harold Arlen and all of those tunes. Those are just the songs you play. So, you know, if you're 14 or 15 and you go on a gig and you're not the band leader, if it's a jazz gig, they're going to start calling those songs. And so you learn them. And there's nothing nostalgic about it. It's not like I had any interest in, you know, the 30s or 40s or 50s. You know, I didn't dress like that or think like that. I had no affiliation or affinity toward that time other than my parents having lived in that time. And it was, that was just the music that we played. And I think the reason it resonated is probably, you know, twofold in that on one level, I was young, you know, I was 22 and I was playing it. And I think, you know, young people tend to gravitate toward people of their generation. And also, you know, I had a lot of help with, you know, When Harry Met Sally. That was a big catalyst in my career. I was able to, you know, go on the road and you know, sell out, you know, venues as a result of film and people's desire to hear these songs. So I was lucky. You know, so luck had a lot to do with it, but it was just kind of a perfect storm for me because I was playing the music that I love to play.
For people who may not be familiar with the Great American Songbook or what we're talking about, let's just hear a little piece of your interpretation of Cole Porter's It's All Right With Me.
It's the wrong time in the wrong place. Though your face is charming, it's the wrong face. It's not her face, but it's such a charming face that it's all right with me. It's the wrong song in the wrong style. Though your smile is lovely, it's the wrong smile. It's not her smile, but it's such a lovely smile that it's all right with me. Ooh, you can't know how happy I am that we met. I'm strangely attracted to you. You see, there's somebody I'm trying so hard to forget. Don't you want to forget somebody too? It's the wrong game with the wrong chips. Though your lips are tempting, they're the wrong lips. They're not her lips, but they're such tempting lips. That is all right with me. Come on, Russell.
That Russell is Russell Malone on guitar, Shannon Powell on drums, two of the greats right there. Did singing come naturally to you, or did you have to take singing lessons?
Well, I used to imitate Louis Armstrong as a kid. He was my hero, still is my hero, and that was sort of the way I sang up until I was maybe in high school, and then I started listening to, you know, everybody from Queen to Billy Joel to everybody, and then it was right around that time I started listening to more jazz singers and listening to people like Frank Sinatra and Nat Cole and Vic Damone and you know, the list goes on and on. But I guess it was when I was 18, I found myself unable to do some of the things I wanted to do because of, you know, technical limitations I had, because I hadn't studied voice before. It did come very naturally to me, but there were certain things that were bugging me. So there was a guy in New York named Marion Collins who I don't know when he stopped teaching or whatever, but he was a great great vocal coach, and I met with him for about a month, and he answered some very fundamental technical singing questions for me. You know, some of the answers I still use today. So, you know, some of those things. So I learned a lot from him, and just did about a month of lessons, but it was enough to sort of answer some real basic questions about the art of it.
Give me an example. Give me an example of one of the techniques that he gave you that you were having trouble with that has solved the problem.
Well, I was singing, you know, from like if your listeners go to a football game and they scream and cheer, and the next day you find that you've lost your voice. Well, there's really no reason for you to lose your voice if you're getting the sound out in the right way. And so I was not aware of that. So I would sing sort of from my throat. In other words, I wouldn't support my my voice at all, you know, with techniques. You know, it's kind of like if you tighten up your stomach, if somebody's about to hit you in the stomach and you kind of tense up. In a nutshell, that's kind of what you have to do when you sing. And I was able to get some of those techniques because my voice would be real tired after a gig. Now, you know, I do Broadway shows, do 8 shows a week, and, you know, with basic proper technique, you can keep on going.
Yeah. I read, and you can't, as you've already alluded to, you can't trust everything you find on the internet about people, but I read that following an unsuccessful attempt to study jazz academically and having given recitals in the classical and jazz piano programs at Loyola University, Harry Connick moved to New York. If that's true, what does unsuccessful attempt mean?
Well, my dad wanted me to go to college. I wanted to move to New York right out of high school. My dad said, listen, give me a semester at Loyola before you go. Mm-hmm. I'm glad he did because, you know, as impatient as I was, in hindsight, I think it's important just for me to develop a little bit more, you know, socially and musically and mature a little bit before I just sort of dove into this career full time. And even though it was only, you know, 4 or 5 months, I think it was helpful to me, and I'm glad he held me back. But it wasn't the right environment for me. Like, I didn't want to be in school. I didn't want to be in that. I had played every place there was to play in New Orleans. I wanted to be in New York, and I wanted to get a record contract with Columbia Records. That was my purpose, because the people who had gone before me, like Wynton and Branford, had signed contracts with Columbia, and that was, I just wanted to make that happen. So I left for New York when I was 18, actually on January the 1st, 1986, and went up there and just started trying to make it happen. And that's where everything started to take off.
Yeah, you did make it happen. You did get that contract with Columbia Records. How old were you then?
I think I was 19 when I signed my record deal with Columbia. I had known the people up there before that, so it wasn't like I went in cold. There was a guy named George Butler who was signing people, and he was the A&R guy at Columbia Records, and I knew him. I had known him since I was 14, and he said, when you get to New York, give me a call. That's exactly what I did, and I hounded him for a long, long time until he finally gave me a contract.
Wow. Yeah, you got a contract in fairly short order. From when you look at the scheme of a person's long-term career, it happened like that. And then they chose you, somebody chose you, to sing the soundtrack for When Harry Met Sally, and that went multi-platinum. What went through your mind at that time? Because something like that changes your life forever, and some people lose control of that life. You didn't. What went through your mind at that time?
Well, I had always wanted to be a popular entertainer. You know, I love being on stage. I had no problem admitting to anyone who was interested that I wanted to become successful as a piano player and as a singer and as a performer. That's what I wanted to do. But I couldn't have imagined with any specificity, you know, exactly how that was going to manifest itself, if it did at all. So when Harry Met Sally came out, in my mind, you know, I had almost willed my career to happen because I was so driven and so compelled to make a career as a performer. But the fact that it was happening in that capacity is what was surprising to me, because you just couldn't have predicted something like that. So I was relieved but I was also shocked that it was actually happening, because it was a really quick ride.
But how do you stay grounded when something like that happens to you? When you go from relative obscurity into somebody who's multi-platinum and is getting offers left and right and has suddenly, at a very young age, achieved the dream?
I'm not so sure how grounded I stayed. You know, I mean, my intent was to try to be a good person and to, you know, be respectful and kind and humble and all that. But I don't think I achieved that as well as maybe I could have. I mean, being 21, 22, 23 years old and having those types of opportunities, you know, I lost my temper at times. I was demanding of my musicians. I was, you know, immature. And so I tried to stay grounded. I mean, I certainly knew what I had to do to you know, make the right decisions. But, you know, I was a goofball at that age and immature. And when you couple, you know, that type of success with youth, it you know, sometimes it can be a little bit rocky. But, you know, I had family and friends who were very helpful and inspirational to me. Like my dad, you know, he's 92, he's still alive and well, and you know, continues to provide, you know, support for me and guidance as I try to navigate through my life and make the right decisions. So I'm not so sure. I tried to stay grounded, but, you know, I did the best I could.
Yeah. You achieved this dream, and the dream was to be a performer and to be a musician. How did the acting start? Because that came very quickly afterward, the movies and television, et cetera.
Well, when I was in high school, I was doing musicals, and I loved it. I loved being on stage as an actor, you know, singing and dancing and playing these roles. So I knew it was something I wanted to do, but I wasn't about to pursue it because I was focused on my music career. But when I was about 20, I was playing in a club in L.A., and somebody came up to me and asked me if I'd be interested in auditioning for this World War II movie that they were going to be making in England called The Memphis Belle. And I hadn't done any film acting before. I had just done some stage stuff, and it was a small part. It was with an ensemble cast of a bunch of really experienced actors, and it looked like a good introduction into that world. That's exactly what it was. It was a small part. I learned a lot. You know, I made some good friends and kind of kept quiet and listened and ended up really loving it and pursuing it from there.
Yeah, acting is a little different, I think, from being a musician. How is it different from your point of view in terms of the way you approach preparation? And do you find it easier than being a musician? I mean, is it more difficult?
In some ways it's easier because it doesn't require the same sort of, you know, absolute technique that music requires, but that's not to say acting is bereft of technique. It's a more abstract form of it, I guess, because everybody talks and everybody has emotions and everybody has feelings, and that's what acting in a very broad sense is. There's a ton of things you have to learn, obviously, in terms of technique as an actor, but with you could take anybody off the street and tell them to repeat a line and they can do it. Maybe awful, but they can do it. Whereas if you tell anybody to play a scale on the piano, they may not be able to do that. It's a different kind of thing. But the process is the same, in that, you know, you're making something out of nothing. And it's not that it was difficult. It's just I was about the same level of an actor as I was as a musician at that age, because my efforts were really strong. But you know, it takes a while to sort of figure out who you are and how you want to say and do things. That just comes with time. So just like in music, you know, it takes a long time to develop as an actor.
You wanted to be a performer. Acting is performing. It's a different kind of performing from music. Does it give you a different kind of satisfaction, or is it similar in terms of what you get from being out there as an actor?
It's similar in that the feeling I get afterwards is the same type of feeling. In other words, if I do a Broadway show, or if I do a sitcom or a film or an album or a concert, you know, I have the same sort of emotional fulfillment after all of those things. I feel like I've spun my wheels creatively, and there's a sense of satisfaction or dissatisfaction, depending on how well I think I did. That's very similar among all of those things. So even though the processes may be different, the feeling of sort of creative and emotional fulfillment is very similar.
To get where you are as a musician, you had to, as a young person, had to practice a lot to build up your skills so that you could be on the same level as Ellis Marsalis is, and Brandon Marsalis, and other people who play in that genre and other genres. But now I guess it doesn't take as much, because it's you have it, you have the chops. And you've said that when it comes to music, at least the music on this tour, you're not a rehearsal kind of guy, and that you and the band like to decide what you're going to play on the spot, and you play it. But actors, unless they're improv groups, rehearse. And that's particularly true for actors in Broadway shows. And you were in Pajama Game. You got a Tony Award nomination for Best Leading Actor in a Musical for that. How does the process of rehearsing for something like that strike you if you're not a rehearsal kind of guy?
Well, you have to be if you're on Broadway, as you just mentioned. I mean, there's no way around it. I mean, you can, you know, try not to rehearse, but you're doing yourself a great disservice, because there's so many moving parts in a Broadway show. But I happen to love every aspect of, you know, this business. And so the way you rehearse for a Broadway show is the antithesis of the way I would rehearse for a tour, but I love it.
More of our conversation with Harry Connick Jr. and his music in just a moment. This is Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
What is the Charlotte music scene? Seriously, what is it? Where is it? How can we find it? WFAE is working on a new series of stories about the rockers, singers, and artists who helped shape the Queen City's soundscape. Submit your story now on wfae.org/cltmusic. Support for this series is provided by Ortho Carolina.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're listening back to our conversation from June with Harry Connick Jr.
I remember the days of just keeping time, of hanging around in sleepy towns forever. Back roads empty for miles. Well, you can't have a dream and cut it to fit. But when I saw you, I knew we'd go together like a wink and a smile. Leave your old jalopy by the railroad track. We'll get a hip double dip tip toppy two-seat Pontiac. Lights and all rights, let's go together with a wink and a smile. Give me a wink and a smile.
We were talking a little while ago about acting and how you got into that, and how that's another, I guess, arm of your desire to be a performer. And you seem like the perfect choice for Pajama Game, a 1954 musical that's part of that genre of the Great American Songbook, and you got to sing a song that became a hit for Rosemary Clooney in that show, Hey There. And let's just hear a little piece of that. This is the portion where you sing a duet with yourself.
Hey there, you with the stars in your eyes.
You talking to me?
Love never made a fool of you.
Not until now.
You used to be too wise.
Yeah, I was once.
Hey there.
Yeah, yeah.
You on that high flying cloud.
I hear ya.
Though she won't throw a crumb to you.
Tell me about it.
You think someday she'll come to you.
Oh, shut up.
Better forget her.
Forget her.
Her with her nose in the
her
air.
Her with her nose in the
she
air.
Has you dancing on a string.
A puppet on a string.
Break it and she won't care.
She won't care for
won't
me.
You
take this advice. I hand you like a brother.
Are you just too far gone to hear?
Is it all going in one ear and out the other?
I didn't know this about you. I knew that you'd done orchestrations and you do big band charts and things like that, but you are a composer and you wrote a score for a Broadway show for which you received a Tony nomination, Susan Stroman's Thou Shalt Not. What's the difference between writing a song, because you're a songwriter too, and writing a whole score for a Broadway show?
Well, it's a lot different. Writing a score is, for me, it's three different things. It's, you have to write the words and the music and individual songs, but then I also did the score itself, which is all of the, you know, underscoring and transition music and orchestration for that. And for your listeners who may not know what that is, like if you go to see a Broadway show and before the curtain goes up, you hear the orchestra playing and there's 15 people in the orchestra, well, somebody has to write the notes that they're playing, and it's a time-consuming process, but that's called arranging and orchestration. So I did all of that for that's what I do for my records, and it's just a different skill set. It's like it's apples and oranges to anything else.
Where did you learn to do that? Because that means you have to have an intimate understanding of what an instrument can do. And if it's not the instrument that you grew up playing, how do you know what a trombone can do or what a violin can do?
Well, I mean, you have to study. You have to learn. You know, things like ranges of instruments and all of that. And like, these are all things I studied in high school and for the short time when I went to college. So I was pretty intimate with the way these different instruments worked.
So let's talk about New Orleans, because you're coming here to celebrate New Orleans. Let's talk about this city. For people who have never been there, how would you describe it?
It's unique. It's a place that loves to celebrate. It has its own type of music, different types of music, as a matter of fact, from, you know, rhythm and blues to brass bands, traditional jazz, lots of different music that's indigenous to New Orleans, and it has its own kind of cuisine. You know, with the way we boil seafood down there is different than any place else, and the mixture of Cajun influence and Creole influence, and it's just a place like no other. And if you go down there, you know, you'll see a city that is so enthusiastic to have you and loves hosting people from out of town. It's just it's a magical place, and I love it, and it's still my favorite city in the world.
How did the music culture develop? Dixieland jazz, which is what most of us associate with New Orleans, is just a part of what's down there now. But I guess it developed there. That's why it's called what it's called. But how did that happen?
Well, I think it's a whole bunch of reasons. I think the influence of men and women who came as slaves from Africa and the Caribbean had, you know, the most to do with it. And then when you couple that in with the fact that New Orleans is a port city, and listen, I'm not a historian, but right. You know, from what I do know, you know, there was a lot of musical influence that was coming from places like Cuba, Europe, and you know, when you meld all of those things together, along with the experiences that slaves had, and with the experiences that people had in places of worship, all of those things led to this new form of music being born, from jazz music to spiritual. You know, lots of these different forms of music were kind of started in New Orleans. I can only imagine how exciting it must have been and how revolutionary it must have been to hear people like Louis Armstrong, right. You know, playing in 1920. I mean, that must have just, it was a new sound. You know, nobody had ever played that before. So it's a long and complex history of which I am, you know, not the person to try to explain, but from what I know, from my personal experience, it was an incredibly magical time for music and for the development of that part of our culture.
There's a lot of different kinds of jazz, but Dixieland jazz seems to have a joy to it, a celebratory nature to it. Would that be accurate in your opinion?
You know, we call it traditional jazz. Most people call it Dixieland. In fact, I did two albums that had that name, Dixieland, in the title. Mm-hmm. But I think the reason we call it traditional jazz is because of what the term Dixie implies. And most, if not all, New Orleans musicians would probably call it traditional jazz music. And it's interesting because when you mention how joyful that music is, when you consider that the folks playing that music were dealing with at the time, you wouldn't think joy would be the first word that came to mind, which right. is why it's such a complex musical form. For the listener, it's the most joyous music in the world. But when you start getting into it and you start thinking about the history of it and what was going on, man, it's really, really heavy, which is why I feel so honored to be able to play it and to call it, you know, my own music. It's just incredible stuff, man. And it's unique to our country. It's yeah. unique to our city. And I'm just so proud to be able to call myself a jazz musician.
When you come to Charlotte, you're bringing, I think, 11 band members with you. Are they all from New Orleans?
A few of them are. All of them are very intimate with this style because of me and the other fellas that are from New Orleans. But, you know, we play all kinds of music from New Orleans, all different styles. You know, I mean, the shows change night to night, but the people coming to the show in Charlotte are definitely going to hear a wide variety of styles from New Orleans, and I'm excited to be able to play it for them.
You talk about, and I've read interviews with you in other cities where you brought this, and you talk about the different styles and genres of music that you're playing, from big band to funk to swing. How does that celebrate the musical heritage of New Orleans?
It's just so diverse down there. I mean, there's so much music. There's so many different styles, you know, gospel music, funk music, parade music, brass band music. I mean, you know, Latin inspired music. Mm-hmm. It's just, there's so much, you know, the New Orleans piano music, you know, lineage is so long down there. I mean, we could play 2 weeks and not play anything twice. There's so much to play.
Yeah. Over the years, I think probably to the large public, great American public out there who are not in New Orleans, when you think of New Orleans jazz, you think of Pete Fountain, you think of Louis Armstrong, I'm going to leave people out here, you think of Al Hurt, people like that. But they're just really the people that somehow broke through to the rest of America. There's a whole bunch of other music down there that people maybe not necessarily associate with New Orleans, but musicians evidently gravitate toward that city because they want to play with other great musicians. Do you think it's a loss to New Orleans that some of this other kind of music is creeping in and pushing out more traditional New Orleans sounds, if that's an accurate way to say it?
Well, I don't know how much it's pushing out traditional sounds. I mean, there's still a ton of people playing traditional music down there. I mean, they just keep on coming. You know, young musicians are playing, they're tap dancing, they're doing all the things. It's almost like it hasn't changed. There's probably less venues, that type of music, than there used to be. But, you know, you also have to consider, you know, jazz music in and of itself is a form of music that pushed other forms of music out. So that's how the music changes. So, you know, you can look at traditional jazz music as this sort of classical music of New Orleans. But the only way it's going to change is if and grow is if there's new influence. And it remains to be seen, you know, what will happen in the next 10, 20, 30 years. But, you know, we welcome that. I mean, there's always going to be the purists and the traditionalists who stick to, you know, exactly the way it's always been done. But, you know, it's hard to tell in real time that the music is constantly changing and evolving. So that's a good thing.
You have 3 Grammy Awards, 2 Emmy Awards. You've received 2 Tony nominations. You've sold millions of albums. You've appeared with accomplished actors on TV and in film and in live theater. You've played with some of music's greats. What are you most proud of?
My family, you know, is what I'm most proud of, because none of that would mean anything if I didn't have my wife, my children, and my extended family. But in terms of my career, I guess I'm the most proud of the fact that I have a career. You know, I'm 50 years old. I've been doing this for 40-something years, and I love it. And the fact that I can tour and do films and Broadway and all the stuff I love to do is, I think that's what I'm the most proud of.
So what's next for you?
You know, well, I'm gonna finish this tour, and then, you know, hopefully, you know, I'm going to go on and continue to do, you know, more projects on TV and film. You know, we got a lot of stuff that we're working on right now, so we're just going to keep developing stuff and keep putting stuff out. And, you know, I just am continually thankful for how gracious and supportive people have been.
Well, I got to tell you, you sound like a really nice guy, and I'm glad we had a chance to chat. Thanks very much for being with us for the hour. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much. Good time.
Harry Connick Jr., musician, Grammy and Emmy Award winner, who has also starred in several movies. We spoke to him before his visit to Charlotte during his tour, celebrating the tricentennial of the city of New Orleans. Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to helping customers select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.